I'm Elizabeth Luby, and I live in Evanston, Illinois. I grew up in Chicago, on the west side, actually on the border in Oak Park, the Oak Park side of the border. Chicago is a town that has always been called a city of many neighborhoods, many of which were very ethnically drawn and divided, probably not so much today as when I was growing up. I am from the west side in sort of a working class, comfortable neighborhood. What next to us was Austin. But the city probably had its most famous areas right along the lakefront, starting in the north with Rogers Park. And then we moved into Lakeview and then into the Gold Coast and down into the city, which is called the Loop, where the business section is, on down Lakeshore Drive into Hyde Park, where the University of Chicago is. These sections along the lake were probably the most wealthy and the most comfortable and where the most beautiful housing was. But the rest of the city enjoyed a very comfortable and attractive ambiance. The working class neighborhoods were sort of gathered on the west and southwest side of the city. One famous neighborhood is Bridgeport, where Mayor Daley was from. It had been traditionally a stopping off place for new immigrants, Lithuanians, Polish, Irish, and is still pretty much an Irish neighborhood. The back of the yard section was very close to Bridgeport. This is the area back of the stockyards where once upon a time the cattle was slaughtered and sent off on the railroads to all parts of the country. The cattle came in from the farms and then went off all over the country. It is no longer in existence, but it was a very colorful part of the city. And now, the book The Jungle by Upton Sinclair was written about that part of the city back at the turn of the century, shortly thereafter, before the labor movements became so big. But the city can be read about in many, many interesting novels, and true and fictional. We produced a lot of great writers. And one of them is David Mamet. And David Mamet's play of sexual perversity in Chicago. I'm going to read just one short excerpt. Joan. I don't know. I don't know anything, Deborah. I swear to God, the older I get, the less I know. It's a puzzle. Our efforts at coming to grips with ourselves in an attempt to become more human, which in itself is an interesting concept. It has to do with an increasing ability to recognize clues and the control of energy in the form of lust and desire, and also in the form of hope. But a finite puzzle whose true solution lies perhaps in transcending the rules themselves and pounding the fucking pieces into places where they do not fit at all. Those of us who have seen the hands of the master magician move a bit too slowly do have a rough time from time to time. Some things persist. Loss is always possible. And now another excerpt from the Chicago Daily News, the last edition of a great Chicago newspaper, March 4, 1978. One of its most famous writers was a writer named Mike Royko, who wrote many, many books about the politics and the life in Chicago. It died just a few years ago, but was always exciting and fun and represented what really was happening in Chicago. From the Daily News, March 4, 1978. About the only good thing that can be said for working on a newspaper that folds is that it's sort of like reading your own obit. Since the official announcement was made on February 22nd that the Chicago Daily News would cease publication on March 4, the nation's press has been lamenting our demise. We've been reading about how we were one of America's oldest papers, 102 years old, rich in tradition and boasting of great staffs, past and present. Most of the obits point out that the Daily News had the nation's first foreign service, and it was a great one. Our Washington Bureau, which was not very big, was also a tremendous contribution. This was the paper that once employed Carl Sandburg as a silent movie critic. Ben Hecht worked here and gathered the material for Front Page. his classic play about the roughhouse days of Chicago journalism. The Daily News invented the Daily Columnist. Our 15 Pulitzer Prizes and countless other awards put us right up there with the best of newspapers. The Daily News was doing investigative reporting, sending politicians to jail when Woodward and Bernstein were only toddlers. Well, when you read enough glowing reports, obits about yourself, you can be pardoned for thinking, boy, we really were pretty good. But then comes down the inevitable question, yeah, well, if we were so good, how come we didn't make it? And that's the toughest part of being on a 102-year-old tradition-laden newspaper that goes under. If it had been a cheap rag, its death would have been easier to take. But the Daily News, while it had some bad days, was still one of the best newspapers in the country. Yes, it was a fine paper and getting better. But in the executive offices, where the bottom line is what they read first, the talk was about the slide in circulation, the resultant loss of advertising, and the growing deficit that would reach $11 million in 1978, more than the other field paper, the profitable Morning Sun Times, could possibly earn. And that is the puzzler. Why couldn't a good newspaper make it? Some say that afternoon papers face hard times for a variety of reasons. The expressways are one factor. 20 years ago, Chicago didn't have any. Many more people rode buses, subways, commuter trains. Many bought an afternoon newspaper on the way home. Now Chicago is a network of expressways, more suburban-bound drivers, and fewer rush-hour readers. There was also the competition from the highly profitable suburban papers, as well as the Chicago Tribune and the Sun-Times itself. Both were morning papers where distribution advantage is immeasurable. Then there were other factors, seldom mentioned by professional press critics because they aren't as easy to measure. Courage, for example. There are times when a paper can have too much of it for its own economic good. That, at times, was one of the Daily News's problems. In the early 1960s, many papers treated the civil rights movement quite gingerly. The Daily News recognized it as the most important story in America. The Daily News was far ahead of any Chicago newspaper in reporting the civil rights story. All of which made the staff proud, but it made many white readers angry. It was a story they didn't want to know about. Almost every day, the circulation director would storm into the newsroom and scream about cancellation of white readers. The editors told him to stay the hell away from the reporters. The irony was that the white readers quit in droves, but almost no black readers joined. In Chicago, Richard J. Daley was mayor, boss, father figure, and the most dominant politician in the city's history. He was viewed with awe by the establishment, common people, and the Eastern press, by almost everyone, in fact, except the Daily News. During and after the 1968 Democratic Convention, the Daily News hit him hardest for his contribution to chaos, and most Chicagoans thought that splitting of protesters' heads in Grand Park was great sport. So Daley got the votes while the Daily News lost readers. When the Cook County State's Attorney's Police raided Black Panther headquarters and two black men were killed, the official explanation was that the police had fired in self-defense. The Daily News said baloney and demanded an investigation. The Daily News was proved right, and more white readers who preferred police to Panther turned away. Courage didn't kill the Daily News, but it undoubtedly shortened its life. And so did apathy. For out of 7 million who lived in the Daily News circulation area, only 315,000 of them thought one of the better papers in America was worth 15 inflationary cents. When a new dictator takes over a country, one of the first things he does is seize or close the newspapers. Apathy isn't as heavy-handed as a dictator, but it can get the same job done.